Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is June 11th, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Tommy, Can You Hear Me? Steroids for Meningitis. And the guest skeptic for today's episode is Dr. Jeremy Faust. He is an emergency medicine resident at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Jeremy is a self-described evidence-based medicine zealot, and he writes a column for ASEP Now on the topic of social media. Jeremy also just launched an excellent new podcast series with Lauren Westerfer called Foamcast. Welcome back to the SGEM, Jeremy.
Thanks, Ken. You know I love the show, and I just want the listeners to know that you gave me this huge honor recently, which was that you bumped me off of the SGEM guest schedule in favor of Joe Lex. And I mean, the Joe Lex, to be bumped off by him is actually kind of an honor. So I was like, it was like being on The Tonight Show. I mean, Joe Lex, I've been bumped for worse, you know?
Well, anyways, tell me more about this Foamcast thing that you started with Lauren. What's it all about?
So I never thought I'd do a podcast because I can barely articulate a full sentence without mumbling. So basically it's like speech therapy for me. But doing it with Lauren is great. She's really knowledgeable. And another surprise is that she's from the South and they barely speak English. So somehow it's working. But what we wanted to do was to address some of the issues that you and actually Nick Jeans and Joe Lex were talking about in your recent episodes, which is the idea that most popular foam comes in two big varieties, the cutting edge sort of off-label stuff like MCRIT and what you and like David Newman are doing with the evidence-based pushing back dogma. And we love that stuff. That's what most people in the foam world love. And we're just like super junkies. But the criticism that Dr. Jeans and the other people in that ilk have brought up is that some of the non-cutting edge stuff that isn't just, it just isn't as consumed by the foamites. So Lauren and I kind of wanted to do a bait and switch where we summarize some foam, a blog or a podcast, boil it down to some take-home points, and then peripherally get involved in some core content based on some readings. So we go through what Rosen says or Tintin Alley, which I call them Rosen Alley, and we do some board review. And I think the main audience is like advanced residents, but I think other people are liking it too because it helps, you know, them keep up with the foam. And so far, it's really been fun. So we're just going to keep doing it until they tell us to stop.
Well, you've got four episodes up now, I see. And if people have not yet put it into their podcast rotation, they should download it. Not right now while you're listening to this, but you should definitely download Foamcast. So, Jeremy, we're going to be talking about meningitis today. So why don't you start with a case scenario that we can base this discussion on?
Okay, this is great. We've got a 24-year-old woman in the ED with 3 days of progressively worsening flu-like symptoms. Her vital signs are no good. 39.6, she's febrile, heart rate of 114, tachy. Her BP is okay, 120 over 80, and her respiratory is 22, but erratic. And you notice that there is a purpuric rash, which is bad, just clinical meningismus. Her white blood cell count is elevated, and her lactate is borderline. The LP demonstrates turbid appearing fluid, but no blood. And it's probably a champagne tap.
So everybody's recognizing that this is meningitis. That's not the question. The question isn't, is this meningitis? The question for today's podcast is, do steroids prevent death, hearing loss, or other neurological sequelae in bacterial meningitis? So that's the question we're going to drill down to. We always like to get a little background information. So, you know, everybody starts at the same sort of level. We know, right, Jeremy? Bacterial meningitis, bad, correct?
Yeah. In fact, three-day history is really scary because people die pretty quickly with this disease.
Yeah, the estimates for children are somewhere anywhere between 5 and 40% and adults 20 to 50% being fatal. And this is even with appropriate antibiotic therapy. And of course, there is this inflammation of the brain and the meninges that causes serious neurological sequelae. And one of the worst neurological sequelae in survivors, so if you survive the meningitis, it's a sensorineural hearing loss. And up to one-third of patients will get this bilaterally post-meningitis. It's thought to be multifactorial. And I pulled a good paper here for some background information, and it was done out of McMaster University in Canada, and it was published in 2003, and it's by Wellman. So just go to the blog and click on it. And he lists four different things that could play a role in this multifactorial reason people are losing their hearing after bacterial meningitis. And I'm just going to run through those quickly. Okay, Jeremy?
Yep.
So it's the extension of the infection along the eighth cranial nerve through the periodic duct and into the cochlear aqueduct. That's the first reason. Then, of course, there's cochlear pathology due to all the serofibrinous exudate, inflammation, and granulation cells. And then you can even get into septic emboli and thrombotic occlusion secondary to vasculitis. And then the fourth thing that they list is a pathological formation of new bone within the otic capsule called labyrinthitis ossification. Oh my goodness, that was a mouthful. Why don't we just get to the article we're going to talk about? What is it, Jeremy?
Okay, Ken, you gave me a Cochrane review, so I love that. You know I love that. Also, I had nothing better to do than to read an entire Cochrane review, so that's awesome. And the article we're going through is Brower et al., and it's corticosteroids for acute bacterial meningitis, and the most recent iteration is 2013, although this has been published in a couple different versions.
So what population were they dealing with in this review?
This is patients of all ages with bacterial meningitis. And they looked at higher versus lower income countries based on the UN Human Development Index scores.
And I think they mentioned that early on because there had been a suggestion that people in lower income countries or developing nations didn't do as well. And so that's a key point, and we'll talk about that a bit later. How about the intervention that they used in these studies?
The intervention that they're interested in is corticosteroids. And mostly they use dexamethasone in the IV form, but there were also other formulations used. The most common dosing scheme was 0.6 milligrams per kilogram per day for 4 days.
And then their control was usual care, and then they had a number of outcome measures. What were their main or primary outcomes?
So the main outcomes were mortality, which is a good one to look for.
And it's a hard one to fake, right?
Yeah, seriously. Not a lot of malingering involved there. Number two, hearing loss, and they broke that into severe hearing loss, which was bilateral loss greater than a 60 decibel change or anything requiring bilateral hearing aids after. And then they also had any loss, that's another. The third is neurological sequelae, so anything focal other than hearing, such as epilepsy, severe ataxia, memory problems, concentration disturbances.
And then, Jeremy, they wanted to look at adverse effects. Whenever you're giving a treatment, you know, you're looking at the benefit, but you also want to look at the potential harm. So what were the potential harms or adverse effects that they wanted to quantify?
They looked into clinically evident GI bleeds, reactive arthritis, pericarditis, herpes zoster or herpes simplex, fungal infections, and then recurrent fever greater than 38 or persistent fever lasting longer than 5 days.
So the author's conclusion from this big Cochrane review was, quote, corticosteroids significantly reduce hearing loss and neurological sequelae, but did not reduce overall mortality. Data supports the use of corticosteroids in patients with bacterial meningitis in the high-income countries, and we found no benefit effect in low-income countries. End of quote. Now, Jeremy, we've got quality checklists that the best evidence and emergency medicine team has come up with. And when it comes to systematic reviews, there's 7 questions to go through. The 7 questions, what were they?
So the 7 questions, we're just going to go right in order. Number one, the clinical question, is it sensible and answerable? Number two, the search for studies, was it detailed and exhaustive? Number three, the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality? Number four, the assessment of the studies, were they reproducible? Were the outcomes clinically relevant? That's number five. Number six, was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome? And seven, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant? Now, these are 7 amazing questions, although they do seem to be more than 5. I'm surprised that you like the list, Ken.
Yes, it did exceed my standard of 5.
But in this case, we read them all at once. We decided ahead because it's nice because the answers agree across the board.
Yeah, we agreed. We put our skeptical eye or critical appraisal eye upon this, and we agree that of these quality checklists, we can agree or say yes to all of these 7 questions. Now, let's go through the key results and find out why we agreed with that. And first of all, they included 25 studies, and that had over 4,000 patients. Now, there were 4 high-quality studies, and those 4 high-quality studies were almost 50% of the whole patient population. And then they had 14 medium-quality studies and 7 low-quality studies to make up that 25 studies that were included in this meta-analysis. What was the overall result? What was the big one, the mortality? What did they find, Jeremy?
The overall mortality reduction they found to be not significant. The problem was that the confidence intervals just went over one. So the relative risk was 0.90, but the 95% confidence interval was 0.80 to 1.01.
And so that's why they can't statistically say that there was a difference. How about when they teased out adults only?
Yeah, same kind of thing. Again, not significant. The relative risk is 0.74, but the 95% confidence interval ranges from 0.53 to above 1.05.
Well, did they find something significant in their primary outcome? Because if I remember correctly, there were three primary outcomes they were looking for. The first one was mortality, but the next one was hearing loss.
Yeah, so they finally found something statistically significant here they can get behind, and that is the reduced severe hearing loss. So the relative risk there was 0.67, and the confidence intervals were between 0.51 and 0.88. So this was something significant.
And I think that's a really important patient-oriented outcome, especially with children and developing and hearing and language development. So if you lose your hearing, you know, that's going to be a significant disability, especially for children. How about just any hearing loss? Because that was severe hearing loss. How about just any hearing loss whatsoever?
Any hearing loss whatsoever is, again, actually significant. The relative risk is 0.74 with good confidence intervals.
And then the third thing, you know, it was mortality and hearing loss. How about just neurological sequelae? Did they find any difference there?
Right. So this was other sequelae like epilepsy that we mentioned up above. And the answer, it did reach significance. It's 0.83 on the relative risk, and it touches one. But everything else below. So I'd say that they got there.
And now those were the three primary outcomes. But the other thing that we always look for is harm. And so, was there any increased harm with the treatment?
Well, there's increased recurrent fever. Some people would not call that a harm. Some people would say fever is your friend. That's really a debate. And it looks like the relative risk there was 1.27 with clinical significance.
And so there was no other adverse events with the steroid outside of this increased recurrent fever. And that may not be a very important patient-oriented outcome. So, Jeremy, then they did some subgroup analysis. I'm not going to go through all the subgroup analyses because I like to keep this podcast between 20 and 30 minutes. Commutable. Digestible, turning your car into a classroom. But I did want to mention one thing in the subgroup analysis because we had mentioned low-income countries, and there was no benefit when they did subgroup analysis of steroids in low-income countries across the board, and that was with the mortality, severe or any hearing loss, or neurological sequelae. So I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned that in their subgroup analysis. But let's get to some comments, though. I mean, this was a thorough Cochrane review, as Cochrane does do great thorough reviews in general. And it was an update of their 2007 review. And they went through all the electronic searches, the manual searches, and they didn't mention any language restrictions, which often comes up where it's restricted only to English. You wanted to mention something about bias.
Yeah, if you look at the paper, there are some really wonderful figures. And one of them looks at whether there's any reporting bias among other forms of bias. And they did find that 70% of the trials had some level of reporting bias. So I think that's actually interesting that they come out and say that.
The other thing I like is that the visual, and of course this is a podcast, but if you go to the blog, the visual when they put up their figure one is on bias. You know, green is good, yellow is I don't know, and red is bad. And you can just at a glance, a blink, shall we say, you can blink at it and go, oh, okay, yeah, things look pretty good there.
Yeah, and that's really just true for the entire meta-analysis in general. There's so many forest plots of so many things they teased out, and you can just sort of look at it and go, okay, yeah, that's convincing or that's not so convincing. And it's a wonderful thing that we have this resource. I suggest everyone go take a look at this and other reviews like it.
Now, Jeremy, you had some questions about heterogeneity. You know, I had put in the critical review that there was mild to moderate heterogeneity among the pooled trials. And the definition they used in the paper itself was anything less than 50% for heterogeneity they'd consider low, and anything above 50%. Now, their pooled trials had anywhere between 0 and 33% on their I-squared test. And now I'm going to get a little nerdy here on you, okay? Just as a rough guide for heterogeneity, if you've got, you know, 0 to 40%, you're probably looking at low heterogeneity. If you're getting in somewhere around 50%, so you're ranging from 30 to 60, you've got some moderate heterogeneity. And between 50 and 90%, you're getting to substantial heterogeneity. And by the time you get 75 to 100%, that's a lot of heterogeneity. And can you actually put those studies together? Are they similar enough to actually be meta-analyzed? Because just because you can do a systematic review, which means you're systematically looking at the literature, doesn't mean you can always mash it up as a meta-analysis. So there was one other nerdy thing that I wanted to talk about, is that all the outcomes were analyzed with fixed effect analytic models. And we've spoken before in the SGEM about the difference between a fixed and random effect model. A fixed effect model meta-analysis assumes that all the studies share the same effect size. So when you put them together, you know that each size you're counting on, you're assuming that they have the same effect. And in the random effect models, we don't assume this, and we allow that there could be some distribution of what the true effect size of the intervention is. I will put up some additional resources there so people can look into this further if they would like to. But I think we've gotten way too nerdy and we need to get back to this Cochrane review. So do you have any more comments that you wanted to make?
Well, the only other comment I would make was that in terms of how they quantified hearing loss, clearly someone who comes in and mom and dad say, if it's a kid, hey, they had great hearing before and now they're deaf. That's going to be pretty easy. But when they're trying to quantify more subtle changes, that was interesting to me. I'm not exactly sure. You know, in some cases they said, oh, we used, 60 decibel change. Well, did they do it before and after? So I was a little unclear on each study how they ascertained this. My guess is that it's a slam dunk in most cases, but it just wasn't that clearly described.
And, this was an update from the 2007 Cochrane database of a systematic review on the same topic. And that did actually show a mortality difference, as well as the hearing loss and short-term neurologic benefits. They had 20 studies in that earlier review, including 2,750 patients. And again, that study favored patients that were in high-income countries. And there's an evidence-based summary of that 2007 review that was done by Sunil Upadhyay, and he's part of the BEAM team, and he published that actually in the Annals of Emergency Medicine back in 2008. The current review, this 2013 review, includes newer randomized control trials from Vietnam and Malawi, and there was no benefits that were realized there. And furthermore, there was a drop in mortality, is noted after the introduction of the H flu vaccination in higher income countries. So I think that's affecting some of the data there. But there was four limitations that they talked about, the authors talked about in the study. Can you just run through those before we finish up?
Yeah, so there are four things here. Number one is the minimum duration of corticosteroid therapy. Number two is the type. So there were different types, I think I mentioned up top. Some used dexamethasone at different doses, 0.4 or 0.6 mg per kg per day. And the other thing that they didn't really specify was the time interval between antibiotics and corticosteroid administration. So was there a long delay between antibiotics and steroids? Was there no delay? Was it an hour? Was it a day? We don't know that. And then finally, long-term effects of corticosteroid therapy.
So the bottom line from this episode is that the use of dexamethasone 0.6 milligrams per kilogram per day in all cases of bacterial meningitis in high-income countries should be used. It may not save lives necessarily, but at least it spares any hearing loss or other neurological sequelae, and it should be given before or with the first dose of antibiotics. You brought up the case. Do you want to bring up the case resolution then?
Sure. The woman with suspected bacterial meningitis is given broad-spectrum antibiotics and dexamethasone at 0.6 mg per kg per day, given at the same time. She goes to the ICU, and you hope she does well. And, of course, you go up the next day to follow up, say hi to your patients who are in the ICU. It really, the patients love that. The families love that. You get the warm and fuzzies.
I like the warm and fuzzies. I like going and visiting. I think it's very educational, and it's also really good. It shows the patients that when you leave, you don't stop thinking about them. I certainly don't. So the clinical application then from this podcast is, if you're practicing in developed country, you should consider giving steroids with your antibiotics in patients with bacterial meningitis. And so when I see these patients, I would say, we suspect that you have bacterial meningitis. We're going to give you broad spectrum antibiotics. But at the same time, we're going to give you something called a steroid. and this has been shown to prevent swelling, decrease hearing, and may even help save your life.
Yeah, and while there are parts of my hospital that do not feel like a developed country, we definitely like to give the steroids.
So for the Keener contest, last week's winner was Dr. John Haggerty from Sarasota, Florida. Congratulations, John. He knew that Carol Spinney was the puppeteer, or Muppeteer, who brought to life Big Bird on Sesame Street, but he also played Oscar the Grouch. What's the Keener contest this week, Jeremy?
Okay. Tommy was the deaf, dumb, and blind kid in the rock opera By the Who. These disabilities, however, did not prevent him from being a wizard of what popular game?
If you know the answer to this week's Keener contest, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener in the subject line. If you're the first person to correctly answer the question, I will send you, even though some people think it's not real, a cool skeptical prize. Now, Jeremy, we've got some upcoming conferences for BEAM, or Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine, that I'm really excited about. We've got a QBEAM, or Quebec City BEAM, and that's going to be in the fall, September 29th and 30th. Have you ever been to Quebec City?
I have not.
Quebec City is a beautiful, old, historic city in Canada with a real European feel. So if you want to go to a really, really good city and a great conference, I would encourage you to check out QBEAM. But on top of that, we also have EuroBEAM. Yes, we're going over to Europe, to Prague, December 4th and 5th. Now, some people have referred to this as Beer BEAM, but no, it is going to be EuroBEAM in Prague. And again, I will put up some links so that you can register early. Save the date. Jeremy, thanks again for being on the show, and good luck with that foamcast. I'm really excited, and I am a listener.
Thanks, Ken. We have a lot of idols and a lot of good people we look up to, so thanks for kind of blazing the trail.
Do you mind giving the tagline then?
My honor. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week. Tommy.